Hello and welcome to episode 76 of The Great and Crowbar. It is the 20th of January 2015. My name is Chris Thurston and today I'm joined by Graham Smith.
Hello.
And Tom Francis.
Hello.
A normal hello and a strange hello.
From now on, Graham is the voice that sounds like that.
For the rest of the podcast.
Hello, I'm Graham.
Good, good.
Actually, Graham couldn't make it, we're just impersonating him. Two people isn't enough for a podcast.
It's actually an uncanny job you're doing there, Tom, of impersonating Graham. Managing to both do your own laugh and Graham's laugh.
Yeah, that was the hard part, was doing a double laugh.
Exactly the same time. Now, we decided, like, a minute ago, what the news this week was going to be. And in that minute, I have entirely forgotten what it was.
It was Sid Meier's Starships.
It was Sid Meier's Starships.
The announcement of a new Sid Meier game. It has his name on it, as they all do, but this one he's actually involved in some way.
Apparently he still does the programming and, you know, actual nitty-gritty design
stuff.
Yeah,
Jake Solomon was saying that. XCOM guy. It looks like Galciv to me. I was going to say Galciv 3, and then I realized I meant just Galciv generally. It seems to be a turn-based civilization building game, but with spaceships in space going between planets.
I think it seems to be less civilization building and more
fleet building.
Yeah, designing your own ships plus adventure, diplomacy. Mm. It sounds like pirates in space, or perhaps what's the other game he's done? Ace Patrol.
Mm.
Maybe Ace Patrol in space. Ace Patrol,
space
being,
patrol.
His war- being his World War II dogfighting game.
The screenshot I saw had planets, and they had little resource lists next to them, like this one that gives you one science, and this one gives you X. So I don't know if that's like, that could be anything really, but...
Yeah, because to me I got like a Sid Meier's FTL vibe off it, like that. The video they released is a cutscene that links Civ Beyond Earth to this game, which is seemingly set thousands of years later or something. Like.
Beyond Earth.
Yeah. Double Beyond. But the suggestion seems to be humanity setting off from its kind of home in the stars to find other humanity scattered throughout the galaxy, which to me has like an FTL vibe, you know, expeditionary fleet kind of thing, or a Battlestar thing going on, but I don't know. I mean, you said there is a screenshot out, right? Like,
there's
a few, and the one I can't remember the others. The one that about Galciv stuck in my brain because I understand what that is, so I just thought, oh, it's Galciv.
From the way it was talked about, I was assuming, maybe I'm wrong, that it didn't have, like, you wouldn't be managing the planets and stuff like that. Maybe you visit them. But it sounded more like it was you were just roving across this galaxy with your, you know, Biostar Galactica sheep? Fleet of
this
ships.
Graham, so just a normal fleet. Space game where you have a Biostar Galactica ship.
This Graham impression's kind of rocky in places, Tom. You need to...
Just trying to make him sound like a fool.
Yeah, I mean, I'd be down for pirates in space. It sounds more aspirational than that. Like, I know you'd be having, you know, dance mini games. And...
That would be cool.
Yeah, it would be. If it was like Firefly.
Yeah, and if like the space diplomacy wasn't just like a pop-up dialogue box, but you had to go dance with the daughters of the governors of these space planets.
Yeah.
Spaceports.
Space planets.
Yeah.
That is very different to Galciv.
Yeah, exactly.
When I did see a screenshot and imagined it as Galciv, I had sort of weird, like, roller coaster emotions, because I was like, at first I was thinking, oh, cool, it will be like Galciv, but like a bit cleaner and a bit simpler and with less. Galciv has a lot of complication that doesn't really need to be there. Some of it's interesting and some of it's just kind of a hassle. And so I thought, like, oh, nice, kind of clean, more streamlined version, that would be good. And then I thought, oh, but hang on, Beyond Earth was actually sort of meant to be a bit like that, but ended up just being really bland to me. I just didn't get on with it that well. And then I remembered, oh, but this isn't by the same guys as Beyond Earth, it's by Sid Meier this time, like he's actually sort of, I think, creatively in charge of it. And then back to, hang on, what was the last thing Sid Meier did that? That would have been a while ago. And then also, Galciv 3, that's coming out. That's going to be a better version of Galciv 2. But is it? Does Elemental suggest that they've lost their way on that? But that's getting better. But then it's getting better because it's actually under the management of someone else. And so I have no idea what to think about this game.
Ace Patrol's good.
Yeah, I think...
Quite lightweight.
Like, yeah, I think that's...
Was that a mobile game?
It came to PC later, but it was originally iPad. Whereas I think this Starships is coming to both PC and iPad, I think, at the same time. Or at least they haven't suggested that they would be staggered.
I was going to ask about that. Sorry, go.
A lot of Sid Meier's stuff is quite lightweight. Like, obviously, Civilization is the complete opposite of lightweight, but everything he's made in the last 6-7 years. Like, I can't even think about what he was. I guess Pirates was maybe, or yeah, probably Pirates was the last big expansive game he made, and then he remade Railroads, and then since then it's been like Civ, Facebook spin-offs, and Ace Patrol, and like really tightly, nicely designed things, but often that they just kind of, they don't unfurl in the way that Civilization does. Mm. You know, you can kind of play them for a week and feel like you're done with them.
There's a significant amount of board game designer to like Sid Meier. Like, and I think maybe there's a degree to which his more recent things could be board games. Whereas Civ is so complicated, you need the computer to pick up the slack. It looks like a board game, but the idea is that the fact that it's a computer game allows it to do things that only the most complicated, tedious board game would be able to do.
Why do you think so many big name game designers end up going in a kind of, or seem to trend towards simpler, more mainstream games, kind of going for the biggest audience and loads of them going to free to play? Like, obviously, Full Frog Guy, flying
Peter Molyneux on him.
Yeah. Hardest name to forget. And didn't like Brian Reynolds join, the other
Zynga.
Yeah. I'm blanking on all names. This is going to be a terrible list of names. Chris Taylor was massively into free to play for a while. And
still is. He works at Wargaming, helping them on mobile releases of World of Tanks games.
It didn't sort of pan out that well when his big free to play push. But yeah, it seems to be the thing to do once you make your name in hardcore games is to go into more mainstream stuff. Do you think that's just because they want a bigger audience, or do they actually, are they all getting old and they don't have time to play the old stuff?
I mean, maybe that's the way you own an entire project now. Like, maybe
has to be small enough for you to be able to.
Yeah, maybe Civ is a rare exception where it does seem to get handed from like lead designer to lead designer. But I guess if you want to pitch a big project now, you have to give up a certain amount of creative control over it, unless you're in sort of extraordinary circumstances. Whereas if you have a vision for something and you want to see it through entirely yourself, then what you do is you pitch, you know, something relatively simple and then just do that well. I don't know. Maybe once you've been to that mill once, you don't want to go through it again.
I think if I was their age, you know, these kid people are in their 50s, some of them approaching or in their 60s. If I was that age, I probably wouldn't want to keep making games played predominantly by 14 to 30-year-old men. I'd probably look around and go, all my 50-year-old friends, including all my female friends, are playing these Facebook games that look an awful lot like things I made 25 years ago.
Yeah.
You probably think, oh, that's an interesting kind of challenge, and try and... I think it would be challenging and interesting to do that, even though I think they're wrong.
I was going to ask, was anybody put off by the fact that it was jointly announced for PC and iOS? Because before we started recording, I was talking Tom about this, but like, I've been playing XCOM. I got an iPad recently. I've been playing XCOM on the iPad, and this is me getting now kind of surprised by technology, like old enough to be surprised when technology does something I don't expect. But that's just a full version of XCOM Enemy Within. That is the PC game XCOM Enemy Within that I really like on a tablet, and there are advantages to having it in a touchscreen interface, and I basically consider it to be a mobile game now, because that's how I want to play XCOM. I mean, it doesn't look quite as nice, but it runs as well. And like, and that is kind of shaking me out of this belief that to put something out on iOS at like a £5, £8 price point, that it in any way denotes the completeness of the experience or the amount of content you should expect or how much mechanical depth you should expect. You know, likewise, FTL made a transition really successfully. I think probably at this point, Civ could, in its full form, make the transition. And I'd be surprised if it didn't. Like, not in a kind of Civilization Revolution kind of mini Civ form, but you could probably just put Civ on a mobile now. 100%. So, I was going to say that I think that... I was interested to note that that told me absolutely nothing about the content of the game, whereas I think once upon a time, something like Ace Patrol even, it would have at least suggested something about the scope of the thing.
Yeah.
But now it's just like, no, I really, you know, for all I could tell, it could be a Civ-scale experience.
Yeah, for turn-based stuff, it doesn't worry me at all. I'm always surprised that they put things like XCOM on the iPhone as well as the iPad. Like, iPad makes perfect sense. It's a screen that's... has a lot of scope for precision, and you know, you can click on small things on an iPad by touching them. But an iPhone is like totally different. It's just fucking impossible to control anything if you have stupid fat fingers like mine. And so, yeah, like Frozen Synapse came out recently on iPad and iPhone, and it has crossplay between them and the PC. It's just so weird to think that thing I'm playing on my PC, like with a massive monitor and a mouse, that you could be playing it someone who's on an iPhone trying to like yeah. on a train trying to touch the right guy. I haven't played it, so I can't speak to whether it how it actually feels, but I can't imagine it working.
Speaking of cross-platform multiplayer, you haven't really rekindled your affection for Hearthstone until you have beaten someone at Hearthstone while having a poo.
I'm okay with that.
Yeah, that's the true joy of the iOS version of Hearthstone. Like, that person doesn't know.
There's no emote for that. There's a time indicator.
I'm having a poo. Greetings. Magic. Tom, you had a space-based experience recently, I think.
Did I?
Space game? Space video game? Am I completely barking up the wrong tree? No, thank God. The segue lives.
Because we're talking about XCOM, my mind is all on Invisible Ink. But yeah, so I mentioned it before, and I didn't say anything about it last time. But I've been playing a game called The Outer Wilds, which is in development at the moment, but there's a free version you can get from their site. And it's not a very... So it's a weird name for what it is. And for ages, I was getting confused with that Badger Sim shelter. I don't know, I just had in my head that it was something like that. It was about the wilds, I don't know, there's probably badgers in it. And then the only screenshots I'd seen were of like a sort of a village, quite crudely rendered, with like not particularly good lighting, and like a weird alien dude, looks a bit like a grey, and it didn't look terribly exciting from that. I guess I'd only seen the one screenshot, because I think the other screenshots show what it's actually about. But you start in this village, you're facing a sort of slightly weird looking alien, and everything's a bit kind of lo-fi in not an entirely charming way. It sort of like looks like they were trying for something they didn't quite pull off with the art. But not like offensive or anything, but just doesn't sell it to you. And then you're at a campfire, and there's a big lift next to you, and they tell you to go and get the launch codes. You don't know what that is really. You can talk to the guy, but I don't know, starting with a conversation is a bad idea for me, because I start at 0% engagement, so the opportunity to learn more and talk to some dude is not at all appealing to me. I'm just like, I don't care, what the fuck, just shut up. And then he mentions that you get the launch codes from the observatory, and you go into like, I could see that there was a thing on a hill that was dome-shaped, so I figured that was the observatory and I should head there. And then on your way there, it takes you through a village, and there's people in the village, and it seems like you could probably stop and talk to them and investigate and like play it like a sort of adventure slash RPG type game. And then when you get to the observatory, there's kind of a museum in it. I just blundered past everybody, didn't talk to anybody, went up the hill to the observatory, went into like a museum-y place, and there's loads of like exhibits and sort of, I guess it's like maybe a science museum, that would make sense. And I think there are some interactive exhibits. There are ones that give you like sort of simulated experiences and loads to read and stuff, and I skipped it all and then talked to some guy who he had the launch code, so I just like skipped through all his conversation, got the launch codes and went back. Turns out this is the best thing to do. Do what I did. Apparently all that stuff is quite fascinating, but it's like, until you've actually played what the game really is, there's no reason to care about it, particularly because it doesn't look that nice, and it just kind of, you don't know why you're there or what you're doing. I guess you could claim that the reason I didn't know why I was there or what I was doing is because I ignored everybody and skipped all the dialogue. But for me, that kind of like...
Is it in Tom, sorry.
Oh, first person.
Okay. That was...
And yeah, so for me, like, finding out more about this stuff through reading and talking to people is not at all interesting. So anyway, I just sped through it all and got the launch codes and then got back to the wooden elevator that you go up into. And then you get into it, like, there's a ship on the landing pad. You get into it by like a sort of grav shaft from the bottom, so you stand underneath a hole and then you can jump and you levitate up into it. And then inside, you can still move around freely, and there's a pilot seat and a suit you can put on and a computer to log into and some like instructions to read. And then you have to play it with a 360 pad. Once you're in the pilot seat, then you can take off, and once you take off, you go into space and it's all completely seamless. Like that little village is on a rocky little planet, and as you ascend and look down on it, you can see it. It's just in this one little crater on this otherwise barren world, and then you're just zooming away until it like blinks out of existence. And there are other planets, and you fly around basically a solar system in which every planet is like incredibly different. So one's made out of vines, and one's like a sort of twin system that where they're joined by a big metal pole, and one's a comet that's actually moving around the solar system, and there's the sun, and there are some other like weird places. And each one of those, when you go to it, has something to kind of investigate and something to discover about it. And all the while, like, there's no kind of landing cutscene or anything. It's all completely consistent. You're just in this ship, and if you want to land on something, you need to fly up to it, match speed with it, rotate, lower yourself down until your ship's feet touch it, and then choose when you get out. And again, when you get out, you're just walking around freely around your ship, and you can drop out of the grav shaft anytime you like. If you get damaged, whether you're in space or you're on the land, or anywhere else, then you have to get out of your ship and use your jetpack to get around to the damaged part of your ship, and then use like a blowtorch to repair the damaged thing, which feels amazing. And you can also, when you're on foot, so you have a jetpack that you can use that basically works much like your ship's thrusters, so it's like you have some of the ship control as well. If you land on a surface, you can walk around on it, as long as it has gravity. And you can also fire a probe. You can do this whether you're in your ship or on foot, and it fires basically a little camera that, as it's going out, there's a button you can press to take a photo with it. And that comes up as like a picture-in-picture display. So you're going around space and landing on all these weird planets that some of them are really hostile, some of them have weird creatures in them. And some of them have some, like spatial anomalies and that kind of stuff. And so you're often encountering things that are really... You don't know what they do, and they look like they probably do something bad. And so the ability to just shoot something into there, like just shoot a camera into that massive tornado, see what happens to the camera, is fantastic. And because you... I don't know why it's done like this. It might be a performance thing, or it might be a design thing. But you don't get a real-time feed from your camera. You just choose when to take a photo. And you can take as many as you like, so you can spam it to get like a sort of stuttering, semi-real-time feed. But that works really well. Like, it has a sort of like built-in comedy to it when you fire a camera into a tornado and you take one photo and it's like looking at the tornado. Take the next one and it's just looking at space. Or you like send it out and it gets flies near like a sort of hostile-looking creature and you get to see snapshots of its life as it goes up to that. And you can just, like, when you're standing on a planet, just fire a camera up into space and use its rear-view camera to look back down on you and see yourself as it, like, blinks away into the distance. And so, basically, it's a little No Man's Sky. And it already exists, and it's free, and you can play it now.
The camera thing sounds awesome. I used to live in a house with some other games journalists, and we had a cat that we got, a cat camera, where we bought it online, and it was like a little container with a tiny little digital camera inside it that you could wear around his neck, and it would take periodic photos. So you'd go out and explore, and you'd come back, and we'd get the camera and look at the photos. And this worked once, and we got the camera back, and it was great, because it was like he was off meeting other cats, he was looking at hot air balloons above Bath, it was grand, he was having this like little adventure all on his own. And then the next time we sent him out with it, he came back and the container was just open and the camera was gone.
Another cat nicked his camera.
Yeah, or he just ditched it, because he didn't want us spying on what it was he was up to. But I really like that.
Maybe
idea.
He saw a murder. Track him down.
Take it.
There was a whole crime sequence. It was like a spectacular thriller, and you missed it all because the camera was stolen.
I really love that idea in video games, though. Like, it's strange that more don't do it. Now that we have renderer engines that can do picture in picture, I want to fire cameras around Minecraft and see what's
miles. That'd be a cool mechanic in Elite for exploration, actually. Something like that for like exploring anomalies remotely. Because there's something about, I guess, getting that sort of like, in some way, disrupted feed of something that makes it more impactful.
It's black and white as well in Outer Wilds, which is cool.
Makes it more evocative than it necessarily would be if you were just like sticking your character in there and seeing what happened.
Yeah, and it's like, it's good because it gives you a way to test something without killing yourself. And also, it tempts you to kind of do it yourself afterwards, like after you've done it. The probe... I don't know, sometimes it loses its signal. It's never really clear what's happened to it, whether it was, you know, ripped apart or whether it just went out of range. But I fired one into a tornado on a planet, and like I say, it got shot up into space, and I saw it, like, each stage of it getting, like, swirled up and then shooting out into blackness. And then after it died, I was like, well, that was a good series of black and white photos of that, but what did you really like? Flew my ship into it and myself shot into space. I was like, whoa, this is cool.
I knew exactly what would happen.
That camera was right.
That's right. I apologise, incidentally, John, listening for this, to the iOS notification sound that occurred during Tom's description of Outer Wilds. The iPad in question has been punished.
The Outer Wilds has just been nominated for IGF Awards, is that right?
No, they haven't. We don't know. Oh, no, wait, sorry, yeah, it is a finalist. Yeah, so the winners haven't been announced, but the finalists have.
Mm. That's cool.
I was a juror on that, and I voted for it.
Huh. So it's you.
It's all me. I'm actually the only juror, so pretty much what I say goes.
I'm trying to think of games that do have cool mini cameras in.
Pokemon Snap.
Terra Nova. Terra Nova, a game I periodically get to go on about on this podcast.
I have heard of Terra Nova.
Terra Nova was I think Sierra game? I think it was Sierra. From, like, the 90s. I've forgotten who developed it, but it had a lot of Star Siege to it. Like, I found it in a bargain bin in Liverpool when I was 10. And I've never seen a copy of it anywhere else, and it's never been on Good Old Games, and it's never been on anywhere else. But it was a game where you could build, like, it had a single-player campaign, but it also had, like, a skirmish mode where you could create, like, an army of mechs and soldiers with jetpacks and stuff like that, and then you could play as any of them. So it was, like, a proper joint arms game where you could adopt first person control of any unit on the battlefield, and there was lots of custom classes. And the two things I remember most about it that I don't understand why they haven't become part of every game ever. One was you could throw a camera robot that you could control with a picture in picture view. So you could switch over to controlling the camera robot and fly that around. The second was it had remote detonated C4 and explosives, like most every good shooter should, but the fuses were color coded. So you would, when you planted the explosives, you would choose whether it was on like the blue switch or the red switch or the brown switch or the green switch, which allowed you to put them in batches. And so you create these plans which involved detonating like the blue explosives and the brown explosives and the red explosives. Terra Nova.
I think in Far Cry 4, when you play C4, when you detonate it, it detonates in chronological order. So the first click detonates the oldest one, and then the next one click detonates the next one. So you can kind of do series in that way. One other note about Outer Wilds in the IGF, it was great that it got, certainly got nominated for grand prize and design, and it was really cool because it was an example of a game that I and most of the people who were discussing it had never heard of it before the IGF. I still don't know who makes it, I know nothing about it except that it was just in the IGF and people played it and discovered it through that, and as the kind of discussion went on, just like everyone who played it was like, fucking hell, everyone's got to play this is incredible. And so it's getting, like, now really big recognition from that. And, you know, could easily win the whole thing. And so just, like, often it's bandied about that, you know, you can't, everything's all, like, connected, and you can't possibly get into the cliques without knowing everybody, and everyone has to already know what your game is before you even enter, because otherwise they won't play it and all that stuff. But actually, no, it can happen with just, like, the game's really fucking amazing, and it can be just discovered from scratch.
I've had it open in a browser tab for about 4 months. I never clicked it down. I just look at the screenshot, and there's not much description of the game, and I just kind of struck my brow slightly, tab over to something else. So, I've been doing that for months.
I mean, yeah, so I did discover it, but probably only because I was involved in the jurying process, which is different to the judging process, where you're just like, there are hundreds of judges, and so if you don't play your games, no one really notices. And I wasn't assigned it as a judge. And I had to be told that it was great like about 5 times before I actually played it. And so that's why, last time I mentioned it, I think I said just play it without hearing anything about it. And then this time I'm thinking like, well, to be honest, that's what I was told 5 times, and I didn't do it. Because I didn't know what it was, and it sounded like some badger game.
I assume this is a badger game, and therefore, in my role as a judge, will not consider it.
Denied. So that's the second tip. Don't make your game sound like a badger game.
Graham, what have you played in January?
Really nothing at all.
Cool.
But an hour of Football Manager, which I also played on an iPad.
How was that?
It was good. I mean, it wasn't... I was streaming it to the iPad.
Oh.
So it was technically on PC and in my house, but I was sat on the couch watching Gilmore Girls.
Living your best life.
Yeah.
Yeah, sounds good.
That's it.
What?
That's it. What have you been playing in January?
So, I went away for a week, because that's why I was on the podcast last week, to attend the Smite World Championships in Atlanta. And then when I got back, I played loads of Smite. And I also played loads of the beta for Heroes of the Storm. So people who occasionally write in to tell me to talk about MOBAs are in luck, because I'm going to try and talk about the championship first and foremost. But it was an interesting experience for that genre in a couple of ways, or for my experience of that genre, kind of being a pledged Dotaman that is now kind of on the verge of accepting a second game of that type.
A MOBAman.
Yeah, I don't like that word.
What do you like?
Wizard.
Alright.
Wizard. I like wizards.
Just a wizard. Yeah.
This is my favourite wizard.
Yeah. It's my favourite wizard, Dota. My second favourite wizard is now Smite.
Smite is the one that's by the tribes?
Guys. Yeah, by the former tribes developers. And through various circumstances, I ended up wearing a tribes t-shirt on the first day of the event. And it was amazing the response that got. Because, I noticed this because I wrote it up extensively for PC Gamer in almost every comment thread. And even when I streamed some Smite the other day, you get people that kind of just descend on it to go like, I don't know what this is, but fuck these guys because of Tribes. And honestly, I thought Tribes Ascend was great. I don't think free-to-play was necessarily the right fit for it, but I don't think the right business model for Tribes Ascend really existed when Tribes Ascend came out. I think the right business model for Tribes Ascend is Counter-Strike Go. Like an £11 game with microtransactions and like community supported tournaments, but that didn't exist then, so I can understand why they went in the direction they did. Nor do I think that this is an aside in a way, but in hindsight, and I actually played Tribes this week, you still can play it. There are about 70 people still playing it in the world, but you can still get a game. In hindsight, I don't think any one company is responsible for ultimately killing Tribes. I think Tribes killed Tribes. Because literally about 70 people ever at the time have been really passionate about Tribes. And that's, I get I'm being hyperbolic, but like...
It's a niche game. It's a niche game. It's yeah. Why when Tribes 2 came out, the development team Dynamics were immediately closed down because it didn't sell that many copies.
Yeah.
And then Irrational did...
Vengeance,
which wasn't that successful. Like, it wasn't like, oh, this is the blockbuster Bioshock hit, and now Irrational, years later, are making Tribes Infinite. You know.
It's like, and that's the thing, like, Tribes it's has true, never been happen. Commercially successful. I think the thing is, and it was interesting kind of getting a sense of the Smite World Championships is an event. Because I think if you know nothing about Smite, you know nothing about Hi-Rez necessarily. The reason that event is interesting as a thing that exists is it's the third biggest prize pool in esports ever. It's $2.6 million. So only the third and fourth Dota Internationals have had bigger prize pools. And it's of the largest debut.
Cause so that's bigger than like any StarCraft tournament?
Bigger than any StarCraft tournament, wow. Bigger than any League of Legends tournament. And it was part community funded. And that's the thing that's kind of interesting about it is... It marked this sort of middle way between what I've come to see as like the two extremes of like game as service management. Like we talk about games as services all the time, right? Like, and most of the time it's in the sense that it's this sort of like evil that's approaching to swallow us all, or to like steal Sid Meier, or like to, you know, whatever it is, whatever context that's evoked in. It's normally we don't want services; we want simple products that we can own, which I respect completely. But there are two halves of that coin. For me, in terms of businesses, there's Valve on one side, who at least will purport to give the audience whatever they want, really. You know what I mean? It's all crowd-driven data. It's wisdom of crowds. It's sort of letting the game be steered by what people will spend money on and how they will behave. And that kind of thing, which leads to Dota's kind of extensive use of crowdfunding for its esports stuff, to like, you know, various experiments with how you get user-generated content into the game, all of that kind of thing, which has real problems. Like, real problems that I think eventually this, I think, is the year where Valve really need to face down that line of thinking and treating it like a sandbox has turned TF2 into a product that nobody understands. You know, that line of thinking has led to a very confused year for Dota, where no one really knows what to expect half the time, because it's really hard to communicate what you're working on if what you're working on is dictated by data that you don't have yet. And on the far end of that, on the flip side of that, you have Riot with League of Legends, who centralize control of everything, from paying pro players salaries to maintain a stable pro scene, to the way they basically run their own community. They produce their own journalism about their own game. They do as much internally as they possibly can. And if they're ever reliant on an outside source, they will do what they can to kind of control that, to the point that they've now recently announced that they're making deals with ISPs to, like, control the network peer-to-peer. At the very basic level, the network functionality that allows you to access League of Legends. Like, that's the granularity of control, right? That's the degree of service where you pay money to Riot for League of Legends, and it's down to the copper wire in the ground that used to access the game.
It's the Apple approach to making video games.
They own that entire sort of system. And in the middle of this thing, you have Smite. So this is more about MOBAs as sort of representative of this kind of like division in business, I guess. In the middle of that, you have Smite, which is a game by a large independent developer. Like, they don't have a publisher, right? They are 150 people. But it's not massive. You're not talking about a corporation of Valve scale or a company of Riot's resources. I don't know how big Riot is now, but I know it's big.
I think Riot's probably bigger than Valve.
Yeah, I think so. But either way, Valve has Steam, so in terms of competition over resources, that's a, you know. That has created a game which is distinctive for being a third-person take on the genre. It has a bunch of things going for it that I like. But is another way, it's not necessarily like that unusual a take, right? You know, there could have been Uber with Monday Night Combat. It could have been...
It's third person as in, it's like over the shoulder?
Yeah, it's over the shoulder. But with some interesting sort of tweaks and to what that means as a game that maybe I can talk to you about in more detail. But like, but they've also run this event themselves, which was part crowdfunded. So like half the Valve model, the prize pool got where it was because of crowdfunding. Using a system not totally unlike the compendium that was used for Dota. But by the same token, they do a lot of internal stuff to help manage the community, particularly through Twitch and like maintaining a lot of their own streams. And they produce all of the kind of content that gets released in the game themselves and set fairly clear schedules for when that happens. One of the only game developers I've ever spoken to who almost operate on a magazine life cycle, which is the deadline that I understand, which is like every month you have to finish a thing. And it was actually a much more positive engagement with a community than I've had in any kind of fan event of that kind recently, because it struck this really good balance between being an event that the developer was putting on, but also an event that the developer had explicitly asked A, the community for help with, and B, was also sort of putting on for the community to a degree. And because the esports scene is itself very young, and it's in that period where a scene is just growing and the resources are just coming into it, where it tends to be the best for team narratives and stuff. People have a stronger sense of who they are, the kind of soup of players that eventually happens, and like the Dota scene hasn't happened yet, if it will. And because of that, it was like, it sort of, I don't know, demonstrated to me that like the polarizing extremes of Riot and Valve can be kind of negotiated in a way that kind of creates something better. Like, I had way more fun than I did at TI4, the 4th Dota International, because it was just a better managed event. Like, TI4 was bigger. It was in a stadium. It was, you know, it was the demands of the audience were bigger, and the demands on Valve were bigger, but at the same time, this felt like a more personable, like negotiation of all the competing factors that dictate whether or not a company can pull off something like that. So the needs of the community versus the needs to kind of control the message about the game, what players need to get the best performances out of them versus what audiences want in terms of entertainment. Like, I'd like to see more like, and I think the game deserves to have its profile rise from here, and I'll be interested if it did, because I'm pretty sure its Twitch numbers weren't anywhere near what LoL or Dota would do in a comparable event. And I'd be interested to see if this translates in terms of growing momentum. Like, if the world has space for another game like this. But I was dead impressed by it. Like, it was such a good time. And the narratives that came from it were so good. Like, the team that came second were a group of amateurs, like, 4 months ago. And they just qualified through every possible qualifier you could get to the point where they were competing for their share of $2.6 million. Which is nuts. Like, that's the kind of fairy tale you want esports to generate at this stage. And almost all of the elder scenes have stopped doing. And, yeah, and it's in a really good place.
What is it like mechanically compared to Dota? Is it, like, as complex?
It's not as complex. I've played a lot of it since I got back. And so, interesting about Smite is it's third person. And there's lots of different modes. One thing it does that doesn't is give you multiple ways to play. So it's just like a fighting mode if you just want to go fight people, not without, you know, worrying about map strategy and stuff. There's a three-lane mode, which I think probably has more in common with LoL than it does in Dota in some ways, but in terms of some mechanics like last hitting and stuff. But the thing that makes it the most different is the perspective. And so it's weird. It's third person, but its aiming is locked to a horizontal plane. So you can't aim up and down. Aiming is always horizontal. And they said they made this decision because it helps to kind of create this idea that you need a certain degree to which players are locked into the lanes and kind of angled lines of sight that the game dictates, because that's kind of how strategy emerges. So they kind of restrict you to this horizontal plane, but it uses the vertical dimension extensively for like movement. So like characters can leap, or like Thor can fly up into the air and like come back down somewhere else to do damage. There's lots of moves that take players up into the air for a while, and so it uses that dimension in a way that other games can't. But the other thing it does, which creates a lot of complexity to a degree, where it loses Dota's item complexity to a substantial degree, and it's not as punishing in terms of metagame stuff, but you can sneak up on people, which you can't do in an isometric game. It just does not work, right? You have line of sight, we have fog of war, but unless a character is literally invisible, like you have a power that makes you not show up on someone's screen, you can't just be behind someone and they not notice in an isometric game. Whereas in Smite, you totally can. And something I'm finding as I kind of crawl my way up its skill bracket is, you know, if people are good, if they are aware of what's happening behind them. Like, the moment where it all clicked for me and I was like, I'm going to play a lot of this now, was, there are two map objectives that are the equivalent of Rishan in Dota. There's sort of like a big neutral monster that you can kill for a bonus for your entire team. One of them is called the Gold Fury, and it's a gold monster that you kill and everyone gets gold. And that's less powerful. The other is called the Fire Giant. If you kill the Fire Giant, then every member of your team gets a buff that increases the damage they do to buildings and allows them to regenerate their health pretty quickly and mana. So the idea is if you take the Fire Giant, then you go siege, you stop, you know, barreling down towers and stuff. It's a big deal to get the Fire Giant. There's another mechanic in the game, where there's an item. So the way it works is you can buy up 6 passive items, 2 active items, and 2 consumables. So your inventory is 10 things total. But unlike Dota, where you can have mixes of active, passive, and consumable, and it all uses the same inventory, the inventory is subdivided, which makes it a lot easier to pass, because it's like, oh, I have space for an active item. What am I going to do with these slots? One of the active items that you pick on a support, initially is just like a kind of item that you activate to nuke neutral monsters or creeps or pets and stuff. It just does damage to NPCs, basically. But if you upgrade it down the right path, it eventually gains the ability to execute the Fire Giant or the Gold Fury when they're under a certain percentage of their health. So if they get to below 20% health, I think it is, or 15% health, the health bar turns gold and you can just eliminate them straight away without having to do the remaining damage. And my favourite moment of Smite so far, and this is something that just couldn't really happen in Dota, or the equivalent would be very different, was losing a game, it's close but we're on the back foot, suspecting that the enemy have gone to kill the Fire Giant, peeking my head around the corner and seeing that, yes, they're all there in the Fire Giant pit fighting the Fire Giant, but they've all got their back to me because they're fighting into the pit. And so I just walked up behind them and stood there, and they didn't see me. And I'm just sort of standing there, not fighting them, not making myself known, but I just wait until the Fire Giant health bar goes below 15%, and then I just run in, execute the Fire Giant, and run away again with the buff, having basically just like done a stealth playthrough of Smite. And that's something that you can't. You can steal Rishan in Dota, but it's a very different thing. It's not literally like, it takes advantage of like game mechanics, like spells and stuff. It takes, you know, hard, kind of fairly hard rules as opposed to the kind of fluidity of just those guys were facing the wrong way and they paid for it, and we won that game. And that was pretty much the play that won the game. And that was a great feeling, like, to be in the kind of post-game chat, and people are like, that steal, though. The other thing about it that I'm really enjoying is it's really friendly on the whole. Like, I suspect it'll get worse as I get better, because friendliness is on, like, a curve, right? Famously, like, new players are really friendly, really experienced players are really friendly. People who think they're good are dickheads, is the general rule for every competitive thing. But you get assholes occasionally, but for the most part, people are nice. And I think one of the ways it does this is, I don't think you can chat to the enemy team during a game, but you can afterwards. So, like, after the victory screen has happened, everyone gets kind of boosted to the lobby, and then you can do all chat. And normally, people in that are like, hey, good job. Or, and infrequently, like,
good job stealing our fucking fire giant.
Yeah, asshole. This guy on my team's a fucking idiot. We've been shouting at him all game. Why don't you shout at him now? but that stuff has been mega positive. And also, actually, weirdly, I've had more games translate into friend requests from strangers than I think I've had in the history of playing Dota. And that's a, you know, that's a, like a, maybe a, I've maybe played 20 hours of Smite, so that's almost a 2,000 hour difference. and I've had more games turn around from almost sure losses. Like actual tilting a game around by force of will.
Is it still the same thing where there's like a base you have to destroy?
Yeah,
you can't, like, destroy it until a certain number of towers are down.
There's a base with towers. Any building behind a tower is invulnerable to the tower outside. So you have to kill towers in order, but you can go down one lane ultimately to the objective. The one thing it does is that the equivalent of the ancient is a titan, and it is just this big giant guy with swords in the base, and it can fight.
All right.
So, like, soloing the titan isn't really possible, but the titan gets weaker the more outer buildings are standing. So if you want to do it safe, you take out everything, because that
gets weaker the more than you take out.
Yeah. So, but if you only take out one lane of towers and the Phoenix, which is the barracks equivalent, then you have to deal with the strongest possible Titan. So it's, you know,
what's the fiction here? Because all the characters are
gods. Yeah, gods from mythology.
But then you fight a Titan at the end.
Yeah.
Okay.
Like
that's a bigger god.
The fiction's as vague as any other game of this type, right? Like, they do some neat things. Like, there are five modes, and each mode is based on a different pantheon from, because it has like seven different pantheons of gods in it.
That's cool.
So, like, the arena mode is Norse, but the more Dota-like mode is ancient Greek, that kind of thing. And that affects how the minions look and how the towers look and all the rest of it. So there's neat stuff like that. But like, in terms of a reason why you're doing any of this, like, it's not the game you play if you want a reason why you're doing anything. You're doing it because you want to kill the other guy's stuff. Like, that's why you play it. But yeah, like, it's made me think again about some stuff I take for granted in Dota. It made me appreciate how much harder Dota is than these games, generally. Like, I kind of get now why people play LoL. Or, like, or why Heroes might be good, because it's like, this is so much friendlier. Like, I get this whenever I play any competitive game now, but, like, this is not horrible a lot of the time.
I found it, so I watched a bit of, might have been the final, I can't remember if I watched all of it, I certainly didn't see the start, but, yeah, just tuning to see how much sense it would make to a total new, because like I watched, we talked before about the international, and I talked about me watching that and trying to understand it and succeeding to a small extent and failing to a large extent. But that was Dota where I'd played Dota, you know, for like 45 minutes. And this is something I've only heard the name. I've never even seen a screenshot, I don't think, before I watched a match. And I found it much nicer to watch than Dota in that I still didn't know what was going on, because you're never really going to if you literally don't know a single thing about the game. But it seemed just visually clearer. It seemed like the lanes were really big and wide and quite visually plain. Whereas Dota, like, it does do some clever stuff with art style where, like, you know, the background is pastely and doesn't have too much high contrast. But I still find it quite visually noisy. When lots of stuff is going on, it's just lots of stuff. I don't even know which bit I'm supposed to be looking at. Whereas a Smite, I felt like, I still don't know what happened in that fight, but if you told me what the blue thing was, I would know what happened in that fight.
Yeah.
I saw the big blue thing, and that seemed really important, and the other things didn't seem so important.
So the other thing is Smite is spectated from an isometric perspective, but played from a third-person perspective, which is kind of interesting when you start to watch it, because you're like, that's not what the players are saying. Like, if someone sneaks up on somebody else, you might, why isn't that guy not reacting? There's a guy right behind him, but, you know, they can't see that.
That makes more sense. Like,
yeah.
Other than to people who play video games a lot, that makes more sense. Because
that's how all sport is done, I guess.
Hey, football man, why can't you see that person behind you?
What's wrong with you?
Yeah, games are weird. I don't know how interested people are in like the tiny details of MOBA design that I've started to think about. But so Smite's map is quite small. And the characters are quite big. And they occupy it doesn't take long to get from A to B at all. Like, the game has a teleport back to base system, but it doesn't need a Dota style, you know, pay to teleport to buildings system, because the map isn't big enough to justify that. You can do that, like, it's just like, but it's like an investment you make for the kind of clutch convenience that will win a game. That's why you have to spend money for it. It's not like Dota where it's just a fact of life necessity that you need to be able to move around the map faster than you normally can because it's huge. And that pays off, I think, in terms of a more friendly spectator experience. That's more action from the beginning of the game. Use more of the map more of the time. The highest level of play, I think, something they're going to have to address, and there's a big update coming to the game fairly soon that will change the map and other things, is that at the very highest level of play, it's quite hard for people to come back from a disadvantage, and one of the reasons for that is that really good teams control the map quickly, and with five people, you can control a relatively small map to a substantial degree, whereas on Dota map, there's always space somewhere. This makes an interesting comparison, and maybe I'll talk about the game in more detail at a different time, but like with Heroes of the Storm, because Heroes of the Storm also has very small maps, and also has very large characters relative to the side of the screen, but it's an isometric game. And as a result, whenever I go back to playing Heroes, after having played Dota, it feels almost unnervingly claustrophobic. Because it's so far zoomed in that it feels like the resolution's broken. Like, I expect to be able to see so much more of an isometric view of a game, like an RTS-style view, where my character's actually pretty small, than of this kind of, like, massively kind of truncated thing. And I don't think it entirely works for Heroes. I think often there's stuff you feel like you should be able to see that you can't, but your vision's limited because the maps are small, because they want the games to be quick. The exact same design principle, small maps, faster game, more action, works so much better in a third-person game because you're less aware of how much you can't see, and your camera isn't just pointing at the ground. They can do things with the horizon that you can't do in other games because there is no horizon in Dota. That's what I mean when I say you can do things with the vertical element as well. That is really cool. And then I think the other thing that makes it more dramatic for spectators is that it's possible to miss everything, like regular auto attacks are still aimed. So if someone is like running away on 10 health and the next hit's going to kill them and they're fleeing from a powerful ranged character that's chasing them down with a bow or something, it's still possible for that ranged character to miss all of those shots if the guy is weaving and juking about successfully. It's not a shooter, but it's got a little bit of that DNA in it. And I mean, that DNA is why Tribes should have worked as a competitive spectator game, right? Like, the thrill of watching someone almost miss a clutch shot as they run away or claim an objective or something. And that, I think, works really, really well for a game of that type, because MOBAs thrive off that degree of chance. Like, the feeling the way you feel when you get away with something. Whereas in like a game like Dota, ultimately they have right-clicked you and their character will continue to chase and perfectly aim at you unless there's a modifier in play, an evasion statistic or a miss chance. You know, there's something else that could create a different outcome. It's the same outcome, but it's like, it's interesting when it emerges from player skill or not, or like the little sort of mushy fluid things of like, did they even see that guy? Which is really different, a really different set of things to consider than... Hmm. It uses part of your brain that's good at shooters, which is a cool thing to have in that genre.
You mentioned wondering whether there was enough space in the world for that thing, but I imagine there are some esports players looking at that $2.6 million picture right now and thinking...
That makes some space.
I'll play that game, and presumably the more that happens, the more the audience will switch over with it.
Yeah, it's really interesting to see what happens next. One of the things I really enjoyed about the event is that, because it's still a relatively small scene, it's still possible to get access to players and to commentators and sort of get input. Like, I think I have a suspicion that esports scenes sort of freeze after their first really big event to a degree. Like, talent will always break through, both in terms of players and, you know, casters, commentators, analysts and stuff, but scenes tend to stratify really quickly. And something as old as Dota, you know, the people casting Dota are the same people who have been casting Dota 1. There's a kind of real... there's a substantial lack of fluidity relative to the size of the thing, right? If you think about the millions and millions of people who watch and play it versus the number of people who move up to graduate to the top level of that, it's really rare. Smite's still at this stage, I think, where there's a degree of fluidity. It's probably going to start to stabilize. And what's going to be really interesting to see is to see if it goes through what other scenes go through with regards to, like, organizational drama, problems with other tournaments, that kind of thing. Because so far, Smite's entire esports scene has been run by its developers. You know, to the degree that they're like Riot, they've kind of made sure it's all sort of worked and been fair and no one's been screwed out of prize winnings yet, or, you know, that kind of thing. And what I'm really interested in seeing, given that I've been impressed by their, like, middle ground approach, whether or not that middle ground approach helps it get through, like, the next stage, which is, like, the road to the second big event, when, as you say, loads of players come in and the audience grows and expectations change, whether it gives it a better shot of surviving that in better shape than, like, Dota did in the last year, where sort of organizational drama is everywhere and it's been seized upon as a thing that will make money both by teams and by tournament organizers. And, you know, like, I find esports in really fascinating in that particular regard, because there's such an unsolved problem. No one's really figured out how to make it sustainable yet. And,
surely there's models just in regular sport. I mean, the number of people, like, playing football versus the number of people who end up playing the Premier League is obviously, it's tiny, but they have youth academies and many, many, many tiers of lower league teams, and they have grassroots football and all this sort of stuff that's designed to give people a ladder to climb in and create engagement at multiple different skill levels and that kind of thing.
I ended up talking to Stuart Chisholm, who's the president of Hi-Rez, about exactly that, because I think it's a really interesting problem. Because traditional sport, if you're really good at a traditional sport, then you are probably screwed by geography, first and foremost, right? Like, the thing that will fuck you is circumstance, right? There are probably more amazing football players than there are ever going to be spaces on football teams. Some of those people will shine in their pub team. Some of them will never shine at all because they don't know they're amazing football players because they're born in a country that doesn't play football, right? You know what I mean? Whatever combination of, like, mental acuity and physical talent it is that creates that, it's a lottery based on where you're born, circumstances in which you grow up, whether or not you get scouted, all of those things.
To an economy of the country you live in and stuff like that. Because why England sucks at football at the national level is because we don't invest money in it. And it's why Britain did so well at the recent Olympics. It's because we were hosting it, and so the government poured shitloads of money into a bunch of sports that it normally wouldn't pay attention to. And then as soon as the Olympics were over, cut funding to all of them. So all these gold and silver medalists were immediately told, well, you don't have funding anymore.
Yeah.
And so that's the end of your career. Thank you. Thank you for not embarrassing us.
Like, but that's a policy problem, whereas what I'm getting at is, like, the real world has physical issues with being fair in its provision of resources and equipment and facilities and stuff. The thing that's distinct about games, and the thing that's completely unique to esports, is that if you watch the game as a sport, you can then go and play it and experience a one-to-one match for what the people on the screen are doing. Right? If you like football, you can't then go and run around a professional football stadium with professional boots on and professional gear, directly comparing your own lack of ability to the ability of the people you watch on TV. You can do exactly that with the game, because there shouldn't be any material difference between the experiences, which means that the potential talent pool is vast. But what I think ends up happening is, you know, I think the Riot model of playing pros basically resurrects it basically simulates geographical and circumstantial problems within a structure. The Valve problem of relying on the free market to essentially shake itself out, again, resurrects circumstantial problems, because there's no official channel for people to kind of play through. There's no way to play through the game client into the pro scene and out the other side. Smite doesn't have that either yet, but they just kind of had it happen by accident, where an amateur team, Titan, went from literally the Challenger Cup, the anyone can play bracket, all the way through to the grand final stage. That doesn't happen. But you know, what I was arguing is if you want this to happen again, you have to be the first company to fix that issue of like not accidentally resurrecting the barriers that drop down in front of people. You know, like, you know, if you're a really talented Smite player, but you're from a country that where there aren't a lot of other Smite players necessarily, so it'd be hard for you to find a team that's as good as you are within a kind of reasonable ping, then, and therefore, or no esports organizations that are likely to help you out, or for whatever other reason, then you face a really uphill struggle just to kind of like get onto the competitive circuit at all. Admittedly, lower than you would be if you were a football player from a town where no one gives a shit about football. But with a decent kind of like, there are ways, I think, to kind of like just have a really open funnel and just pour everyone who plays the game into the funnel and just to shake out the best people and then channel those people directly into a position where they can at least be seen playing. Because that's the thing about these games, is like the audience for them is the same people who play them, which isn't the true of traditional sport at all. So you can kind of recycle the audience into itself in perpetuity. And that, I think, is what esports just haven't done right yet. And like, the final thing I want to say about it, because that whole line of thinking has changed the way I think of games as service. To like loop it back to like what I was thinking about, talking about at the beginning, it's like, when you talk about games as service, you normally think about the service really being, usually being rendered to the developer. Like, you, in addition to getting a game from them, you are giving them something in perpetuity, right? Like you agree to be a boon to them as a number on a subscription roster in order to receive X amount of video game per month or whatever it is. It's an MMO or a free to play thing that you stick coins into the slot. I don't think sports can work that way. Like, I think sports need to be to a substantial degree owned by the people who play them. You are allowed to pick up a ball, go and put some shirts down in a park, and play football without being accused of game piracy, which is crucial. And the way that manifests in games is slightly different. I think Dota gets it right, because you don't have to pay for any of the things that make the game competitive. You can play the full competitive version of the game for free. I think Smite gets it right, because unlike a lot of free-to-play games, like Tribes Ascend, actually, it offers a one-off fee that gets you everything, and that's going to be true forever. So it's like £30, I think, but that gets you every character in the game and every future character in the game. So it's the "I just want to buy this" button. It's almost like the opt-out of the free-to-play model,
yeah.
Which Heroes desperately lacks. It's my biggest criticism of that game, which LoL lacks. And that, I think, is the way that the kind of the games as service thing justifies itself, by giving you the ability to just sort of own enough to kind of determine your own engagement with the competitive side of it. You democratize the competitive side of the game. You take away the notion that if you want to be competitive, you pay forever. Defang the competitive side of the game. Sorry, defang the servicey nature of it, and it becomes something that the community kind of owns and then subsequently generate for itself. Sort of an unfinished thought, but something I've...
Do you want to get that?
The doorbell just rang, so we should take a break. But to finish, I think what we'll find is there are two types of games as service. There are games as services which are subscription entertainment services that essentially you're getting as much out of it as the developer are, and there are games as service in pursuit of becoming something like a sport, where the notion is that the player base should always be getting out more out of it than the developers, but also generating more than the developers over time. End thesis.
Shall we do questions from questions?
Yes.
You sound unsure.
Oh, no, I'm perfectly... I'm down. I'm down. But are you down, Graham? As you scroll through the weapons.
Putting my phone into airplane safe mode. Andrew writes, "Dear fateful faux pas, before the holidays, I enjoyed the rather wonderful CNC episode 70. Specifically, the question about hats that led to a discussion about periods."
Yep,
that sounds like us.
"From this, I thought that the point about Assassin's Creed often giving you inappropriate clothing was interesting, and I was reminded of the intimacy sections in Dragon Age Origins. This was always ridiculous, since you could be flirting with someone while still wearing plate armour and possibly being covered in gore. But particularly because of a bug in my game where the player character didn't remove their armour while doing the deed. This led to a frankly quite unerotic scene, topped off by the sex cutscene not being classed as a conversation. So not only was I still wearing full plate armour, my character also chose that moment to put their helmet back on. Also regarding Assassin's Creed and stealing outfits, you might remember that killing people and stealing their clothes was a prominent mechanic in Commandos, the, especially now, hard-as-nails Nazi knifing and crawling simulator. My favourite part of this question, however, was when you got into doing your makeup in RPGs. I think that this could be a viable mechanic in a traditional kind of D&D system, where one possible class would be a high society type, and instead of equipping armor for combat, you would equip flashy clothes and do your hair for civilization. I was thinking about how this would work around combat, and I think it could work around a system where you use different sets of armor for different purposes. In combat, you could change to wearing leather armor and be a charismatic type of rogue, while in society, your warrior could change to wearing chainmail under a tunic to look less like the maniac at the party. Do you know of any games that utilize a system like this? And if not, do you think that this would solve this particular disconnect between fantasy and reality? P.S. Pip is an excellent participant, and a very Pip problem should be a regular section of the podcast. Hurrah for dissonance! Andrew.
A very Pip problem is a regular segment in Pip's life.
I like this question.
It's a good story about the Dragon Age bug. Yeah. The idea that, like, you're already in armour when flirting and, like, in the love scene, and then when you go to actually making love, put your helmet on. Because it's a combat situation. Yeah, exactly. Take this seriously.
Hang on, Morrigan, I'm fetching my sex helmet.
I really like the idea as well of, like, conversational stealth. You know, like, a lot of games use the metaphor of combat for different types of conversation trees and that kind of thing. But dressing up a certain way, not just to fool people into, you know, not noticing you because they think you're a guard or whatever, but to treat you differently in conversations, that could be a cool thing to tie together mechanics.
Desperately want the RPG where, like, the practicality of equipment is considered. Like, I think I might have spoken about this on the podcast before, or maybe just in a pub. But, like, something that really bothers me about RPGs, outside of, like, the Diablo, the purpose of this game is to find loot thing, is that the concept of loot moves in the opposite direction to how the narrative of a fantasy story should normally move, where, you know, normally, it's the beginning of the story where the hero finds the famous sword that they then hold on to for the rest of the story, that sting in the Hobbit, whatever it is, right? Like, normally equipment kind of gains meaning over time as people have experiences with it, or something becomes precious. Whereas in games, it tends to be that equipment is ephemeral, like, you find new stuff immediately, and armor can be switched on or off based on what the scene needs. So, if your characters attend a ball, which happens in, actually, Inquisition's a really good example of this. There is a scene, without spoiling anything, where the Inquisition attends a masked ball. And for the purposes of that event that are social, all the members of the Inquisition are in, like, a uniform. Like, they wear the same clothes, but they're in, like, a kind of, you know, dress clothes for the purpose of the ball. When you transition into the combat areas within that mission, your armor kind of springs onto your character's bodies in certain seconds.
Like, yeah, it takes you to your inventory, and then you've got to, like, manually equip all your guys, and then, like, tell them, oh, yeah, you should use your weapon. You should use your armor. I'm going to use my armor. I'm going to use my weapon. And you should use your. Fucking hell.
Something about that for me sort of spoils the illusion a little bit. Like, what I want in that section is for the challenge to be added. You didn't come here with armor. Maybe you could sneak your weapons in. Like, you know what I mean? Something like that kind of solves the problem. Weirdly, the one that got that right was Mass Effect 2's Kasumi DLC. Where at the beginning, Shepard and Kasumi, the new companion, attend a ball. And Shepard's in a dress or a tuxedo, and Kasumi's there kind of incognito. And you give the gift of this massive statue of Saren, the baddie from the first game. You're trying to break into this guy's vault, basically. The ball is a cover for a heist you're going to do. And then when you get the statue, because it gets delivered to the vault, it's kind of your way in. And when Shepard himself or herself gets to the vault, he like runs over and opens the base of the statue, and a shelf comes out that has your weapons and armor, like actually uses the right models for your weapons.
Trojan Saren trick.
Yeah. But at least the game explains how that happens, and then it does like a time passing cut to establish that the armor doesn't miraculously appear. You know what I mean? It's not just like a bite, like, you know, that it actually has physical presence in the world. And from that point, you're not allowed back into the party because you're now, like, you're now at that point, that's the point where you commit to, like, you've changed, you know, into your gear.
And Morrowind did have some NPC reactions to what you're wearing. So if you're wearing, like, just wearing a full set of iron armor was not considered good clothes for society. They were considered sort of low class, and so people were a bit derisive of you. But if you wore, like, a fancy, puffy shirt, they would, like, compliment you on your clothes and stuff. And if you're wearing nothing at all, then they all had special lines for that. And obviously, it's like Imperial-occupied Morrowind, so most of the guards are Imperial guards. And the Imperial Guard reaction to you being naked was... they had a bunch of them, but one of them was, "Ugh, spare me." And I remember hearing that a lot, so I must have spent a lot of time naked in Morrowind. But it was... I think they kind of chickened out of it a bit. Like, if you had really good armor, then that was treated as fancy clothes, so people respected you for it. And I can't remember whether it actually changed their disposition bars. I guess I probably wouldn't have even noticed, because it's not that important in most cases. But yeah, I like the idea of tailoring what you're wearing for appearance's sake. I sort of role-played it a bit in Morrowind, because I had lots of characters, but one of them was a Khajiit assassin who, because she was just about pure stealth, she was amazing at stealth, and her only weapon was, the only thing she was good at was daggers, and she's only really good at them, she got backstab, so you had stealth for that. But also she was, I can't remember why exactly, I think it must have been the missions I was doing, but I was sticking around Vivek, which is the capital city, and it's made of these big floating cantons, they're like kind of pyramids with different tiers of markets and stuff on them. And it's policed by the ordinators, who are the those guys aren't Imperials, they are like tribal sort of respected religious guards who are like high up in their society and just fucking hate everybody. They literally just call you scum to your face no matter what you're wearing. So it's like a high security environment, and so it wasn't necessary, but the way I kitted out my character, because she had no armor bonuses anyway, she didn't need any armor. She just wore a robe. That was her only thing she had equipped at all. And her only other possession was a belt. And when she put on the belt, you can imbue different bits of armor with any spell effects you know. So any spells that you have knowledge of, you can add them to an item. And you can make it something where, like, add a fireball to a sword, so that when you have that sword equipped, you can choose to cast a fireball. But also any of those effects you can make into... You can choose how it's applied, and one of them is constant effect, and that's the most powerful thing, obviously. If you have constant effect heal, that means you're literally regenerating health all the time. And so it's very expensive to do that. And also one of the schools is conjuration, and you can conjure like allies, demons and stuff to work for you. But you can also conjure equipment, which is true, I think, even in Skyrim. It's like an Elder Scrolls staple. And so the thing you conjure is like the best bow in the world, or the best dagger in the world, or the best sword in the world. So I had a belt that would have a constant effect of summon dagger, and is this like twisted, like gnarled, spiky Daedric dagger that's fucking badass, and it only appears when I put the belt on, and when I have the belt off, all I have in my inventory is a belt. So for security purposes, I'm completely innocent. I have nothing suspicious on me whatsoever. I get through metal detectors if they had any. And then when I want to actually kill someone, that's when I put on the belt, dagger appears on my hand, kill them, and then take the belt off again. There's no evidence.
It's game?
Completely forgotten what I was going to say.
That's awesome. I think, yeah, the Morrowind is a really good example of a game that not only engaged with me, I think it's having characters respond to what you're wearing was cosmetic to a degree, like in terms of whether how seriously it affected actual playing of the game, but also made equipment mean more than just always wear the best stuff, or, you know, collect, you know, this gear and then discard it for the next set of gear. Like,
the other thing it did brilliantly that I really disliked in a lot of RPGs is that it didn't have any level restrictions on any gear. So anything that you found, you could just wear. And there's, rather than, it did have some leveled enemies and stuff, and I think there were, like, if you opened a chest in the wild, you could probably be, have some leveled rewards, like, appropriate to your level. But a lot of the world was pre-built and fixed, and so there's a plantation, I think it was the Drenin plantation. They are, the Dark Elves are just a bunch of bastards, really. And they have plantations where they employ, like, Khajiit and Argonians as slaves, essentially. And so those guys are rich. And in the Drenin plantation, there's, it's got a bunch of their family just walking around the house all the time. But on their shelf, it's just, like, a full set of the best armor in the game. And it's worth, I didn't care about the armor because I was a thief. I think it was the same character. But the armor was worth like 868,000 gold. And I was like, if I can just pick that up, if I can just find 1 second when they're not looking, or when I have enough stealth that it doesn't matter that they're looking, and then I can just take that and I can sell it and I'm just set for life. And I think I pulled it off in the end, just through like using chameleon spells and stuff. But then of course you have the old Elder Scrolls problem. No one has that much money. So it's like, you can never quite shift. It's the goods that are too hot to shift because no one can actually afford them.
It feels like this is stuff that pen and paper does much better than actual games do. Like, we complain anytime a game takes away our regular powers and then puts us in a situation where we really wish we had the powers you just, didn't just take away from us. And that's maybe what it would feel like if you, you know, had to put on a fancy tux to go to a party, but then a fight broke out and your first objective was go get your equipment back. You know, that's turned up in a bunch of games and just been tedious. But if you were just role-playing that, that's a really interesting situation to be in.
Like, I mean, this, we have a question subsequently, which I know was asked in a previous episode about stuff like this, but it is something that's come up where with pen and paper, I feel the need to help explain how stuff is happening with regards to your equipment in a way that games don't bother doing. You know, a really simple example would be, you're entering a village, and I would like you to be able to remain relatively incognito for a while. So, as GM, I just provide you with, you know, cloaks and gear sufficient to hide whatever weapons you might be carrying, if any. Which is just, like, it's shorthand for, this is how you're doing this. So, rather than just have it be totally ignored, you know, because, like, the game thing would be, you just walk in, and you've got a huge claymore on your back, but no one gives a shit, because that doesn't really count as a thing in the world that people care about, right? Like, you know, the NPCs aren't programmed to think anything of the fact that you've got a weapon on your back, and the game sort of treats that as like, oh, that's just what your character looks like. No one else, people see them like you see them. It's just a cipher, right? And which games, I think that's what I want from RPG Terminator. I want that extra step, because it feels so rewarding when games do that. And it's not necessarily just lampshading stuff. It's acknowledging the physical reality that the characters occupy. You know what I mean? Like, you want to have to solve the combat challenge where you don't just want to do the puzzle where you walk to the chest to get your gear back. You want to get in a situation where you want to get your gear back, but you wear plate armor, and plate armor takes several minutes to put on, so you don't have time. Or, like, you need help to get it on. Because that's how plate mail actually works, right? Like, people have squires for that reason, because they strap themselves into their armor.
This should be a part of the Game of Thrones game.
It totally should be. Your squire has just been, like, assassinated. And you can't get your plate mail on in time. So what do you do? You know what I mean? Like that, like, it sounds so pedantic, but in a way that's kind of way more interesting than like, oh, I'll just right-click onto my inventory.
Put it on the floor and fall backwards.
Yeah. And try and pull the strap back up. Lolling around on the ground trying to get himself into a plate mail.
Like, and then realise it's too heavy for you to get up once you're on your back.
This would also be like a great quops type
thing. But yeah, like, I want the opportunity to do that kind of analogy. Like, in the, you're at a ball and a fight breaks out thing, you suddenly have this scenario where if you've managed to have a secret a dagger on your person, that's a big deal. Because, you know, the reason people use hammers and stuff traditionally in combat is because it's really good against plate. But obviously that'd be the hardest stuff to sneak into a ball. So you should be asked to make that strategic decision. Like, what weapons do you want to sneak in with you? And they should all be bladed, because the chances are that anyone who's going to attack you will be dressed the same as you are. You know? Like, shit like that. That'd be so cool.
Does Dragon Age or Mass Effect ever do the thing of, like, you know, you just had a long conversation with a character and you're going to bed with them, and then a combat sequence breaks out then and there? Or is it always partitioned into, no, this is the sexy times and the fighting times will happen later?
Sex almost always happens in the camp or on Normandy or like wherever the kind of safe area is. There is one instance in Mass Effect 2 where you can die during sex, but it is the sex that kills you. And the best thing about it is it goes straight to the regular you died screen, like as if you'd just been hit by like a gun or whatever, for various space alien sexy time reasons.
All right.
No, I can't think of an example where...
I think it's actually... Like the romance scenes are kind of a optional thing that you could be doing with any one of, like, seven different characters, so I guess they wouldn't have, like, a major, you know... And that's when the Harvesters invaded or whatever, because it would be different.
But it would be interesting to just... Like, I always... Games do a very good job of establishing rules and structure and then repeating on that, but I always like when they then surprise you by suddenly breaking the rule that you thought they'd established. Like, you get a lot of games... first-person shooters in the 90s that would have hub worlds, and then you would suddenly get a hub world that an enemy would be in the hub, and you would be like, yeah, but I can't get hurt here. This isn't a place where I get hurt, and then the thing would attack you, and it would be like something in your brain pops at that point as you suddenly get unreasonably overwhelmed by, like, oh, I never knew!
Yeah.
That kind of thing.
The Walking Dead did that when it kind of turns a dialogue into an action sequence. I actually did think of an example from a BioWare game. It's not quite the same thing, but at least of it acknowledging, like, the reality... Because what we guess we're talking about is, like, the reality of your inventory. It's the same problem
having
as, like...
Having it be, like, having integrity to it. Like, it's what I always like about, as well, the really shitty Alone in the Dark game from, like, 2009.
I was going to mention that. There's stuff in my coat.
Yeah, look, that's my thing. That's where I keep it.
Like,
it's the complete opposite of Guybrush putting a dog down his pants.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, because that, you know, you either make a joke out of it or you explain how am I carrying this stuff.
Hmm.
And the one example I can think of where BioWare did do it is there's a sex scene in Dragon Age 2 between whoever Hawk is and... a character called Isabella, who's like the sort of the dagger wielding rogue you get in your party. You have like a crossbow rogue as well, and her thing is like daggers and throwing daggers, and you see her for a few different occasions like throw daggers from like a belt and stuff, whereas in game terms she has two daggers and on her back. But the sex scene is done so that it sort of starts with them just making eyes at each other over like by a fireplace, and then it cuts immediately to like the door of Hawk's bedroom being kind of like kicked open as Hawk kind of like staggers backwards, half carrying, half being kind of like pushed by Isabella. But as she's pushing slash half being carried by Hawk, she's also trying to disarm herself because she's covered in knives. And so she like throws one dagger off her back and then throws another dagger off her back. And then they both kind of collapse backwards onto, well, Hawk collapses backwards onto the bed with Isabella on top. And then there's this sort of moment of like a kind of really tense pause, and then Isabella like reaches down and pulls another dagger out of like her waist and then throws that away. And it's just a sight gag, but it is that kind of, and it's a fairly simple joke, right? Like she carries a lot of daggers and that is now a sexy problem. But, but like, I guess what we're asking for is like that, but where it actually acknowledges the decisions you've made as a player, right? So it's someone entering a sex scene, but suddenly ruining the fact that you've kitted them out in heavy armor, right? The point where they're like, shit, these straps take forever. And the moment is slightly, you know the bit in Watchmen? Like there's the Watchmen comic or the film, there's Night Owl in Watchmen. Like there are two sex scenes with him, and it's kind of done to frame the way that the fact, how empowering he finds being a superhero, even though he denies himself it.
Yeah.
So when he tries to have sex, when he has sex as a superhero, it's like, it's sort of like, I guess, pornographically unrealistic, but like everything is kind of perfect, and then someone leans back on the flamethrower button on his owl jet at the climax. Whereas when he tries to have sex in his regular clothes, half of it is spent trying to get his trousers off, because he's awkward and awful, and the whole thing is disappointing, and nothing happens.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you kind of want that degree of physical verisimilitude in a BioWare game, where it's like two characters are really having a moment and they're about to kiss, but it's really hard to kiss someone through the helmet of a plate of like a visor.
Like, Hawk has that massive thing in front of his or her neck.
Oh yeah, that huge
sticky uppy neck protector. Yeah, it's like, damn it.
Yeah, like
I my chin pinched in your armor.
Yeah, like or like, you know, someone in full plate attempting to kiss a dwarf. Like, because he can't bend over like, beyond a certain
I'm going to have to lift you up.
Yeah, like, There's so many, like, yeah, there are a lot of possibilities there.
It's funny how this question ended up being about romance and armor, which was the last question as well.
Yeah. No, this is that question.
We're talking about the last question we're answering is the one about changing your clothes to, oh yeah, sorry, same question.
Yeah, this is the same question, yeah. No. Basically, yeah.
I guess something like
more sexy physical problems.
Not just sexy physical problems, but like this is also why stuff like Die Hard and The Matrix are cool, and games very rarely touch on that stuff, that thing of, I have a gun in my hands, but look, there's another gun in that floor. Like, Mirror's Edge does it actually better than almost any other game. Halo limits how many weapons you can carry at a time, but it doesn't feel like you're making that decision of quickly pumping off the rounds in one gun and then throwing it away. That's not a sexy problem, it's not a weapon. Throwing that gun away and quickly
picking up the mine you did while saying pumping off.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, I guess that's the next step. Like, that's the degree of fidelity of, like, control and how you express that information quickly to the player that games need to get at. Like, I think the RPG is a fairly good vector for it because you can do it with so simple information. Like, you know what I mean? It doesn't need to be complicated in terms of what the player has to do in a split-second moment to have a gag based on the fact that someone can't get their plate off fast enough. Whereas, like, that moment of, like, two people going for a gun during a fist fight, like, that requires really complicated inputs to not be a quick time event. Right, to not just be shit. But I guess that's like the level of verisimilitude that, you know, maybe in 10 years, that's what games look like, where you can have that degree of fluidity of control, that you can have systems generate a moment where two people who are having a knife fight both grab for the gun at the same time.
That would be really cool.
Yeah.
Jesse asks, dear CNC Gaming Factory, despite my best efforts to generally avoid paying attention to Steam achievements, I recently found myself doing some strange and tedious things in The Witcher 2, all in the name of obtaining the bloody things. Likewise, I try to be disciplined while playing games like Far Cry and Assassin's Creed, and not chased after every pointless collectible. But sometimes I still find myself doing this despite my best efforts not to. The rational part of my brain hates this, as my gaming time is quite limited and precious to me, so it's foolish to waste it in this manner. But sometimes I just can't help it. If there was a way to remove the existence of Steam achievements from Steam altogether, I would do this without hesitation, and be happier for it. What are your feelings in regards to Steam achievements, and if you also fall for their traps, what is the strangest thing you found yourself doing in order to get one? For the record, I couldn't bring myself to satisfy the Troll Slayer achievement, as it just felt too cruel and heartless. Cheers, Jesse. What's the Troll Slayer achievement?
I do not know. The troll. I remember in The Witcher 2, there's the first troll you meet, at least, is a really nice, friendly one who wants to help you out.
Okay.
So I guess you have to kill him.
Huh.
That's interesting to hear, though, because I had to come up with achievements at gunpoint, and I was kind of... There's a mindset of gamers that I don't relate to about people who love collecting things and they've got to find every last one of the pigeons in, was it San Andreas or Vice City or something? The hidden packages and...
Condemned had dead pigeons. I think you were playing just dead birds. Stuff them in your jacket. Integrity of inventory system.
GTA 4 maybe? Pigeons? There's one where there's just pigeons. Anyway. Doesn't matter what they were.
GTA 4 had shooting pigeons.
Yeah. And I don't understand, I don't feel that way at all. Like, if you tell me I've got 100 things to collect, I'm like, well, I won't do that then.
Yeah.
That's an easy call. You said I had 2 things to collect, I might be interested in. And so I wondered about, like, should I be just, like, putting that shit in there just for the people who like it? Like, because it's not difficult to put in, it's the easiest thing in the world. Like, there are lots of ways to do that, and I didn't in the end, the achievements are mainly for things that I think you should do, or they're to tell you you can do something. And the only ones that are kind of difficult to get, or in some way, sometimes you get 2 different achievements for, or an achievement for each of the possible ways of handling a certain decision. So in order to get both of them, you'd have to play through the whole game again, or like manually save or whatever. And my argument when I was thinking about maybe I should just add that shit anyway was like, well, the people who don't like it don't have to do it, so it won't hurt anybody. But this email suggests it will hurt somebody. There are actually some people who don't want to be compelled to do that, but are compelled to do that. Like, they don't enjoy the process, but just because there's an achievement for it, they feel like they have to. So I'm glad I didn't go down that route.
There are definitely tricks of human psychology that are being exploited by these things. I think some people find it And I think I sometimes can find collection mechanics in games relaxing. Like, it can feel like tidying up in the way that, in the way that games like Tetris or, you know, other good games can. But mostly I've never been into achievements and anything because they feel external to the game in a way. Like, I will sometimes try to clean up a mini-map by doing pointless tasks, and that can feel quite nice, but that's rare, and I don't notice achievements until they pop up, and I read the name of them and think, oh, I don't know what that means, and then never check.
I really used to feel this. Like, I think I would be happy for Steam achievements to be removed entirely. I kind of agree with him in that regard. I think it's notable that Valve removed them from Dota. They used to be in Dota, but Valve totally removed them because they were like, this creates completely undesirable behaviour in players, because it was stuff like, it was dumb things like, use 1,000 tangos, which is like the thing that allows you to eat a tree to regenerate health. So you get whole groups of people who don't care about the game and just care about achievement, who are just like, I'm just going to buy loads of tangos and eat trees this entire game. Because video games. So they removed them, which is telling. Like, I think it's all to do with how they're presented. Like, Steam achievements are presented as so kind of empty of meaning and arbitrary that I find them quite easy to ignore. Likewise, since I've been playing, you know, some PlayStation games recently, PlayStation trophies feel fairly arbitrary and easy to ignore. They fill into categories that are kind of confusing if you don't pay any attention to them, and it's all tied to percentages of completion that don't really seem to mean much, so it's sort of fine. The one that got me was, like, before I had a gaming PC, this is now going back 3 or 4 years, I did almost all my gaming on an Xbox 360. And Xbox really, you know, they kind of invented achievements, but also they really foreground them. So it contributes to your overall score in a big way, so that, like, right next to your name is the score associated to how many achievements you've got. On any given game, as you're browsing through your library of games, is a bar that fills up based on how many achievements you've got, which is the thing next to the game's name. So it's like, you know, if it says, I don't know, Bioshock, and you feel like you finished Bioshock, and you've seen everything in Bioshock, but the bar's only 40% full, it always puts it in your face. Like, and I really did. Like, I used to plan, like, oh, this is how I'm going to do 3 playthroughs of Bioshock to make sure I get everything. this is how, like, I have all of the achievements for Mass Effect 1, and that's insane. Because that game has some fucking weird achievements. That game has an achievement for completing the majority of the game with every squad member, and it has, sorry, it has one achievement for every squad member, where the majority of the game is defined as 75% of missions, and there are six primary squad members in Mass Effect 1. And so it's only ever possible to get that achievement with 2 of them in a given playthrough. So that's a minimum 3 playthroughs just to get that one achievement with each of the squad members, and there's so many kind of configurations that you're looking at. Like, I think the minimum you can do it all in is 3 or 4 runs through the game, and that's dedicated solely to getting those achievements. And I did that for some reason. I mean, I love that game, and I subsequently replayed it on PC. Didn't redo all of the achievements on PC, but, like,
would your experience have been better if that bar wasn't shoved in your face?
Yeah, it totally would have been. Like, I played the game like twice because I loved it. A further 3 times, because I felt the need to express my love for it by giving it a full bar. Like, because it was my favourite game. And because it was my favourite game, it felt weird that that bar wasn't full, whereas the bar for Tomb Raider Underworld was. Because I also really liked that game, but that had easy achievements. You know what I mean? Like, that felt wrong to me, so I had to correct the injustice by filling Mass Effect's bar. And so, like, somewhere in, like, the 11 times I've played Mass Effect 1, that part of it was like, I feel there's a weird obligation to salute the developer by completing their fucking arbitrary challenge room. Like, you know, that is how I have come to play the Pinnacle Station DLC that no one else has played so much, but
like the gamer score thing, it feels like even for the players that do enjoy that stuff, it creates something bad at the society scale.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, it takes all the shitty principles of capitalism and it layers them on top of an entertainment and enjoyment in a way that even if you like 100% in games and get something out of that, it still encourages this comparison between, I got a bigger gamer score than you, son.
It's
I'm hardcore because I've got 100%.
Yeah, I think that was part of it. Like, I didn't want to
given how much I love Mass Effect, I didn't want to be accused of being less of a Mass Effect fan because someone else could be like, well, I have all of the achievements.
It's when you die and other people come along and look at your Xbox and go, Chris, he really liked Tomb Raider Underworld.
Exactly.
I'll let the minister know and he can mention it in the
We'll say that as his
new one. We all knew Chris's love.
Primarily, Chris is a fan of Tomb Raider Underworld.
Still like it more than the new one, but like.
I think Underworld's all right. Is that the one after Legend?
Yeah.
Yeah, I really like that one.
Legend and Underworld, though, 100% of both.
The thing I was going to say is Microsoft's attitude. I mean, the Xbox ended up being a success, but their attitude to games is that of an adult who doesn't understand games. It's like, I've heard about games. They have scores, right? So let's make the score like an important part of every single one of them.
God, they have it totally is.
They have these restrictions for developers where if you want to make, I don't know what it's like on Xbox One, but for 360 certainly, Live Arcade, your game has to have a leaderboard. Has to have a leaderboard. And it has to have certain things to do with like a certain features on the main menu, has to have certain options. Mm. And they've just got an idea. Here's what a game is. It has a score, it has a leaderboard, you can be the best at the game. You've got to beat your friends at the game. You've got to beat your friends at Braid. Braid's got to have a fucking leaderboard. All the Telltale games have to have a fucking leaderboard for an adventure game. You've got to beat your friends at Wallace and Gromit.
Someone on Twitter mentioned that when you load up Alien Isolation on Xbox, it comes up with that message at the start that says, don't turn it off when it's quick saving, because then your save won't work.
Yeah.
Does the game have quick saves? Because this person was tweeting to say, it's a game that doesn't have quick saves. You've got to go to a big chunky machine in the world and use this device to save it, but it still comes up with that message at the front.
It does have auto saves between locations. So.
Okay.
Because like, if you transit between zones, it saves. So.
That's what I was wondering.
Mm. So there. Yeah. But nonetheless, Microsoft are bullshit.
That message is compulsory. Jonathan Blow is one of the many people who's bitched about this. It's absurd, and it takes up huge amounts of developer time, and it's mostly what certification is for. You know, when people can't patch their game because it has to go through a 5-week process and cost them $10,000, it's because they have to check it has a leaderboard in it. If they don't check it works, as Fez demonstrated. You know, Fez's patch broke the game. They didn't check whether the patch worked. They just checked that it had leaderboards still in it. And that took them 5 weeks and $10,000. And so, one of the other things John Lowe bitches about is that please do not turn off your console while it's saving thing. Because that message is a mandatory thing every game has to have. Not only does it has to have it when you boot up the game. So it's like, it has to be on screen for a certain number of seconds. So it, you know, adds time to actually even starting to play the game. And it's also technologically completely avoidable. The only reason you need that message is because when you save, it directly overwrites the save file instead of creating a new file, and then when that successfully is written, deleting the old file, which is perfectly safe. You can interrupt that any time. If you interrupt it in the middle of it, then the new save file will be corrupted, but the old one won't be. And because it directly overwrites it, which it doesn't need to, it's just programmed that way, every game ever has to have that same fucking message. They all have to design it. It has to be like different. They have to have their own little fucking spinning logo for it. And every time it saves, it's got to be showing that on screen. And it's just wasted hundreds of hours of developer time.
It feels like that's an enormous waste of time for developers, whereas achievements, which is an invention from the same spirit, which is like, how do we get people to kind of invest extra in their game?
How do we
double games? That is not only an imposition on developers' time to include, it has been a collective imposition on like everybody's time. That's what I mean. I think I agree with you on it being like a social problem, because it's like, You've at some point, you've made people feel bad about their degree of engagement with the game that they enjoyed. On the flip side, you've made people invest heavily in bad games because it's easy gamer score. Like, famously, the King Kong game for the Xbox. It was like an easy 1,000 points, man. You should get that shit. Like, it's awful, is what it is. Like, I don't even know why it's in Steam.
When you read, like, an awful comment on the internet about casuals, shitty casuals, with their opinions of games being wrong because they're casual, it's like, that is a person who is maxed out their gamer.
Yeah,
well, proud of
that's that, and that's the, like, that's the mindset you don't want to reward. You know, like, here's another avenue by which to kind of demonstrate.
We encourage it. We don't just reward it. We encourage it, and in so doing, kind of create it in a way. Like we,
you like metrics to compare yourself pointlessly with other people. Boy,
yeah.
Well, we got the numbers for you. I think that's probably the thing about Steam achievements is they're so sidelined that no one has ever meaningfully compared them. I guess. Have they? I guess sometimes I find them quite useful if I'm reviewing a game and I've just finished it. Scanning the achievements I haven't got
shows me how much I have missed and therefore I need to go back and look at. That is literally probably the only useful thing an achievement list has ever done.
I'm slightly wary as well of websites where you plug in your Steam details and it tells you like how many games you own, how many hours it will take to complete.
Oh, that's been doing the rounds recently, yeah.
There's been another one doing the rounds recently, but they come up quite often. But all that does is encourage people to buy games as a like willy waving contest of like, look how many games I own. They would take tens of thousands of hours to complete.
You've gamified gamifying games at this point. Yeah. If I wanted to get all the achievements in this, it would take me a really long time.
Look at all the money I spent to no ostensible value to my own life.
Yeah, if only someone would create a kind of game rank micros. Anyway.
Id, a.k.a. Seldom Bucket, writes, Dear Crate and Owlbear, Chris has mentioned the Numenera campaign. Oh, I should say, this is a question we asked last week on the podcast, but Chris, you weren't here for that, so we kind of bounced off it and talked about some related stuff, but I thought you could give us an actual answer. Chris has mentioned the Numenera campaign he's been running a couple of times in previous podcasts. Having just started running a D&D 5th edition campaign for some of the Forumites, I wanted to ask, what have you taken from your video game experiences to utilize in your GMing and story writing? Any tips? Also, would you care to regale us with some tales of your players' exploits? Thanks for reading, everybody. Ed.
It's kind of tricky, because, like, I think one thing we've encountered, and it's probably fair to say, is, like, If your experience of RPGs comes from games, computer games, then the kinds of things you expect to be able to do in a scenario are shaped by the kinds of things you expect to be able to do in a game. Like, likewise, the fluidity with which something can transition from being a regular situation to a combat situation, I think feels more abrupt to computer game players. There was a scenario in the last session we played. I listened to the audio recordings of the sessions to help me plan the next one, but something I was listening to recently and something that came up was, there was a moment when the party decided to, or part of the party decided to intervene in a man, in the beating to death of a man. They decided to get in the way. And I said, okay, so for the purposes of combat, we're going to treat that as kind of an initiative benefit. I said that because we'd entered the combat rule system, but the system is flexible enough that that doesn't necessarily mean, you know, the screen has flashed and you're in a Final Fantasy battle sequence now.
And what a grid appears on the ground.
What it means is that, per the rules of the game, we now need to use the kind of set of rules to decide the outcome of the kind of violent encounter between people, even if no violent encounter subsequently takes place. Like, because you gave me a decent reason to, I ended up cutting off the combat slightly early because you know, you kind of wounded the last guy, and it kind of made sense for him to give up and whatever. Like, there's a degree of fluidity on tabletop that games don't have, because games traditionally really telegraph their breaks between, like, this is a talky bit, this is a fighty bit, this is an explory bit, and the first difficult thing is getting players, I think, used to the idea that, like, if we're switching to the combat rule set, it's just because of what you've suggested that you might be about to do, not because I'm telling you, literally, this is now fight time. You know, like, you still have the power to go, I don't fight.
Yeah, we were able to make use. I've really enjoyed the kind of flexibility that Numenera has that a video game doesn't. And so in that situation, it was a situation where there's a big crowd of people watching some people set upon this guy, and it was clear that they had their own mysterious logic for doing this, and Graham and Marsh were very keen to intervene and were like yelling at them or sort of like telling them to stop and getting involved, and I was trying to be culturally sensitive and staying out of it. And so I said, like, well, I don't actually reveal that I want to stop these people, I'm going to kind of stick with the crowd and pretend I'm okay with it. And that ended up being important later in the combat, because it meant I could get the jump on someone because they weren't expecting me to be on these guys' side.
With regards to tips. Let me think. I'm trying to think of, like, stuff I've learned directly from games. Well, a lot of the stuff that I've done, or I tried to do, has been responses to things that I wish games would do better, like just the verisimilitude of the world and the practical reality of getting by. Like, I try and I try and mention constantly, like, what people are eating, and, like, roughly when they're eating, like, where their supplies are coming from. Like, obviously, for a while, the game mechanic was built around the fact that you didn't have any food, which is solved in kind of spectacular fashion by blowing up a lot of cows. Well,
space cows.
Future space fantasy cows. But, yeah.
But when it comes to, like, hey, we're on a 3-day journey across the wilderness, I don't necessarily want that to be a thing that passes anything other than description, but I still want the player party to know where are their meals coming from, what are the resources like, when are they sleeping, where are they sleeping, how is that occurring? Like, not to dwell on it, not to, like, write a novel about, like, what it's like to sleep under the awning of a flying fantasy vehicle, but, like, to at least express a little bit about what that's happening, because I think it's game, something that frustrates me in games is the lack of attention to detail, to the small details of somebody's life. Like, not, again, not to just, you know, make, not to make you play Don't Starve, but to kind of offer you that detail if you want it. That, like, hey, in this part of the world, they eat patties of dry fungus. And that's, you know, if you really, really want to get into it, that's, you then have a sense of, like, what your character's last meal looked like. And that's the kind of the important detail. Things I, let's think. I think in terms of general tips, I would say plan. So, I don't know. I mean, I haven't GM'd D&D, so this is slightly different, but it definitely works in Numenera, because I changed the way I wrote the scripts for each session quite substantially over the course of writing them. Originally, I treated it like you might a game world, I guess, where you would plan all of the individual elements that are in play in a given area and map them out almost without the element of time. So you know that in this environment, there are these characters, here are their names. It's really important to have names planned, because being asked to come up with a name for somebody on the fly is like death. It's like,
well, that's Trevor Jones.
Yeah, exactly.
Growl the Brave.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, make sure you've got the key information, names and such, but like, I used to, like, plan asymmetrically, so I was like, a bit like if you're a game developer creating a level in a game where you don't really account for the player's movement between the level, you just create the map, right? And then what happens next is the player runs around and does whatever they want to do, because the map, at that point, doesn't need you to maintain it. Big difference with pen and paper is you have to be there to make the map real, which means it gives you a degree of control over the chronological element. So it makes a lot more sense to plan these things not as, like, just fucking sprawling conspiratorial spider diagrams of how lots of different game elements relate in a given environment, but as more like a series of if-then clauses that kind of clearly chart a course through something, but with the knowledge that at any given point you might need to break the script and move to a substantially different part of the adventure. So I think I stopped planning spatially and started planning chronologically. So it's like, in the last session, the player characters came across a village where something weird was going on. And I knew from the beginning what the final reveal of that session was going to be, which was that across the lake beyond the village, what they thought was barren land surrounding a kind of enormous, you know, monolith that they were approaching was not actually barren, but was actually, there was an invisible fortress that they were going to run smack into. There were about 5 different ways through that entire encounter, which would give them varying degrees of warning about what was going to happen. But rather than try and create this kind of completely open sandbox where those eventualities could be reached in lots of really complicated ways through interactions of lots of things that I didn't meticulously plan, I just created kind of 5 paths. And if one of them started to go a bit wonky, I'd kind of shunt you onto the other one. Not abruptly, but like by saying, you hear shouting from the shoreline now. There's a thing happening, because I've known at this point that you're ignoring the other thing that I've just like dangled at you. And I think this is probably really basic stuff. Like, it's just teaching myself. So it's like GMing 101, I guess. But yeah, like in that sense, the advice is, to an extent, don't plan like a video game. Plan like a play. Plan like a movie script or something where you know what the scene you have in mind is. You've just got to give the players routes through to get to it, if that makes sense. In that particular event, to tell a story, rather than do the kind of sleuthing, investigative level, nitty-gritty village stuff that I thought the players might do, which would have included one really cool thing that I'm going to have to repurpose, because it was really cool and I need to figure out where somewhere else to get it in. They shot an old man, killed three dudes, mortally wounded a fourth dude, rescued someone's granddad, attempted to run over some kind of mutant, fled across the lake and almost crashed into a fortress at full pelt without really any heed for how much noise they were making. And then, you know, writing the next script stems from that at that point. It's like, you don't have to then, you can discard so much of the previous one. You can throw away everything they didn't see and just transplant it all onto the new scenario, which now begins with them entering in like the highest alert state possible. Whereas otherwise I'd be writing a scenario from they have swam the lake and they're in, and no one knows they're there. Right.
Hmm. We should have swum the lake.
Should have gone to the little huts, man. There was stuff in the little huts.
Nick Wheeler writes via Twitter, most hilarious death of an NPC?
I assume this can extend to enemies. Like, it'll have to be like a named Mass Effect character, right?
Yeah.
Because their deaths are generally not hilarious. An old favourite from Deus Ex is putting a proximity mine on an alarm panel and then setting off the alarm, or just getting seen, because the first thing they do is run to the alarm panel, and then when they get close enough to activate it, the blast kills them and destroys the alarm panel so no one else can set off the alarm. But I had one the other day, so I haven't played that much recently, except my own game, Heat Signature, which I'm working on, and that did have a series of hilarious NPC deaths, where there's a bug with a thing that used to work, and now it doesn't work. And it's because I'm redoing the code, and I'm making the code more logical, and by making it more logical, I've perhaps made it more weird. So when you get shot, if you board a ship in Heat Signature and someone shoots you inside that ship, then you don't die, you just kind of lie on the floor bleeding out, and they come along and they pick you up, they walk you over to the nearest airlock, and they throw you out of it, and then you're in space, and you have a chance to recover. But the problem was that now when an enemy comes over and picks you up, they pick up your bleeding corpse, they throw you over their shoulder, and they walk towards the nearest airlock, and then if another enemy sees them, they're like, fuck, it's the player, open fire! And because you're unconscious, the normal like logic for getting hit by a bullet doesn't apply, so you don't get shot. But the guy carrying you does get shot, because when an enemy is in the way of a gun, it doesn't care who fired it. Like, guns kill people. And so the shot kills the guy who's carrying you, and then the body hits the floor, and as soon as enemies see that the player is unconscious and on the floor, they're like, oh, we should go and pick up the player and throw him out the airlock. But also, for some reason, in their alert state, their speed goes up, and that doesn't get reset now. So when they go over and pick up the player, instead of walking casually over, they go at full alert speed. So the guy who just shot his friend sprints over to the corpse as fast as he can, then snatches you up and then runs to the nearest airlock. And then, like, another guy sees him on his way and starts opening fire on him, guns him down and kills him. Then he runs over to your body, snatches your body up. And it's like they all desperately want to be the guy who throws you out the airlock. If they see anyone else, they'll kill their friends. No, I want to throw him out. No, I want to throw him out.
That's awesome. Are you going to leave that in?
Probably not. Like, every bug, I'm always posting about bugs on the Heating Actually Twitter account, and I did it for Gunpoint 2, and in the last 4 years, I think every bug I've ever posted, someone has said, leave it in. If I did that every time, you'd end up with not so much a game as a surrealist nightmare, which is perhaps a worthwhile thing to make someday.
Can't really think of an amazing procedural one, but I guess the last one that made me laugh was, like, I installed a bunch of new Skyrim mods and I was playing it again, and I don't know what broke this, but you know the very beginning of Skyrim, I think it might have even been the alternate start mod, something like that, but you know the beginning of Skyrim when you're on the cart being delivered to the place where you're going to get executed, there's, like, you know, Ulfric, the kind of the guy who killed the king, bound and gagged, there's, like, Ulfric's mate, you know, Norseman, Jim Norseman. And, like, there's, like, this thief that's been captured along with you, and the thief's, like, the unsympathetic one, because he's not part of the Civil War one way or another. For some reason, I've arrived at a problem now where whenever I start a new Skyrim campaign, which I do for testing quite a lot, the very first thing that happens in the game is the kind of titles come up, your vision unblurs. It says, like, The Elder Scrolls 5. Skyrim. And then the horse guy goes, ah! And rolls off the back of the cart and rolls away. And then the rest of the cutscene takes place in its entirety, including people responding to what the horse thief has said. But obviously the game, the simulation is intact enough that the horse thief doesn't speak, right? It's not like his voice lines don't play, right? The character is dead and far away by this point because the cart's kept moving. And But the rest of the NPCs maintain the charade that he's still there. And then at the beginning, when you get off the cart and you're led away, he's supposed to, like, bolt and the archers shoot him as he tries to escape. And they do half of that. So, like, one of the guards goes, like, stop! Stop that man! And then the archers just, like, don't do anything. And then everyone else is fine with it. So it's like, it's really weird. I have no idea what's causing it, but it's like, every time it sort of completely ruins the opening of Skyrim, because it becomes really silly. But at the same time, I'm quite attached to it now. Like, everyone just has this breakdown about this one man who kind of was never really there. Like, a little fiction of everybody's imagination.
There's a great NPC non-death in a YouTube video of a bug with GTA 5's cutscenes, where...
Oh, yeah.
Who are the first two characters you play as? Not Trevor, but the other two.
Michael and...
John GTAman.
John GTAman and Michael. Let's assume that's their names. They're in Michael's house and talking on the sofa, but for some reason the game simulation has kept running, and I guess the player had a bounty on their head, and so... The police have arrived and they got inside the house. And so while they're having a conversation, sitting on the settee, and one of them's walking around, like drinking, I think, the cop walks in through the door and, like, is yelling all his normal NPC barks over the cutscene dialogue and opens fire on them, starts shooting them. And then more cops arrive. There's like a couple of cops just shooting them constantly, like blood stains are flicking over the place. They're getting the wounds and everything, but they're not reacting otherwise. And they just carry on with the cutscene while they're being shot at.
I love the fact that those characters, even during cutscenes, still have like collision meshes and stuff like that. For some reason, I'm always surprised when NPCs pop up in cutscenes, not only due to bugs, but then still respond to the player character and that sort of stuff. Because there was lots of videos of Assassin's Creed Unity as well, of just like the main character having very stern disagreements with French noblemen, where they would just be like gawking pedestrians that are like,
who would like start a conversation with you? So. Yeah.
There's do you remember GTA 5? There's a great GTA 5 video of it's a wonderful interaction between AI where the player blows up a car, I think. And then, like, the burning car is on the side of the road. And then the fire engine shows up to put out the flaming wreck. But there's another car in the way. And so the hose from the fire engine hits the regular car that's in the way, which counts as an aggressive action against that car. So then the driver of that car gets out, as if he would if you had rammed his car or shot his car or something like that, runs over to the fire engine, and goes to pull one of the firemen out of the fire engine, like in this kind of traditional response routine. And that triggers the firemen to go into their "we've been attacked" routine. And
so all like, the firemen do it as well.
And so like four firemen kick the man to death in the street, having just fired a hose at his car. And the player does nothing. The player's interaction was just blowing up like initial car. But because of the way the AI works, a man gets kicked to death by firemen for no reason.
What's great is that after that, the ambulance turns up to take away the man. The fireman just kicked to death.
Yeah. And the ambulance bumps into someone else's car. I don't know.
Oh man, yeah, that was good. I like that. We should put that in the show notes if we can find it.
I remember this isn't related to the question now, but I guess it was a funny NPC death. I once solved a problem in GTA 3 where I needed to get up onto a roof of a building. There was some, I don't know, pickup up there that I wanted, and I couldn't find any like steps or anything else I could jump off. And so I beat a man to death with a baseball bat and then waited for the ambulance to show up and then stole the ambulance and parked it in front of there. And ambulances are basically a set of steps. They're like a low bonnet and then a higher roof of the cab and then an even higher back thing. So you just walk up it onto the...
Problem solving. That's all the questions we have from questions.
And therefore all the podcast we have from podcasts. If you'd like to send us a question for a future episode, we'll normally put the call out the day we're recording, but you can always send them to us either on Twitter, at Crate and Crowbar, via email at questions@crateandcrowbar.com, or on the forum at crateandcrowbar.com/forum. If you would like to tweet us as individuals, which is a weird phrase. We've been saying it for like 76 episodes now, but it's still weird. If you'd like to do that, you can find Graham at...
Gonnas, G-O-N-N-A-S.
Tom at...
Pentadact, P-E-N-T-A-D-A-C-T.
And I'm at C. Thurston, which is C-T-H-U-R-S-T-E-N.
Thanks for listening,
everybody.